Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Last week, if you missed it, we talked with Benjamin Wittes of Lawfare, Jonah Goldberg, Rick Wilson, Natasha Bertrand, and Julian Zelizer. And we covered a lot of ground, a lot of it having to do with the Mueller report and impeachment. And at some point, we're going to turn the page on all of that. But there is so much to talk about, and we've invited back one of our favorite guests, David Preece, who is the chief operating officer at the Lawfare Institute, and served under President Bill Clinton, George W. Bush. He's a former CIA officer, intelligence briefer, State Department desk officer. We've talked about his book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives, which... Again, I've said this a lot to our guests over the weekend, but that seems kind of timely, doesn't it, David?
It does seem to be relevant to today's times. Amazing how that works out.
It does. Well, I want to talk about a piece that you co-authored over at Lawfare with General Michael Hayden. Yes. And, of course, former director of the National Security Agency from 1999 to 2005. Principal Deputy Director of National Intelligence after that from 2005 to 2006, Director of the CIA 3 years after that, and author of two books, Playing to the Edge and The Assault on Intelligence. So you, David Preece, and Michael Hayden wrote a piece, What Mueller Got Right. It is interesting that there's kind of a little bit of a pushback among even among supporters of the special counsel, critics of Trump, sure, sort of feeling that he didn't go far enough. They dropped the ball. I assume that you and General Hayden wanted to jump to his defense.
Yeah, we see it slightly differently. We recognize the points being made and respect them. In fact, Shanlon Wu at CNN, who wrote an article on this, Paul Rosenzweig at the R Street Institute, who wrote in The Atlantic, they make valid points. But from our experience with Bob Mueller, different experiences. Michael Hayden and I did not, in fact, overlap. But in talking about this, we realized we saw eye to eye on this, that based on our experiences with him, he did exactly what we expected he would do. He stayed in his lane. He defined his role very narrowly. And instead of that being a bad thing, instead of that being a missed opportunity, instead of that being a lost chance to characterize the president's actions, as Paul put it, we think, in fact, that set things up really well for what is coming up next. So, first of all, it's a good thing to get it's always a good thing to get Mike Hayden back in the public discourse. He's been absent for several months because of his stroke, but he's able to jump back in. We should all be grateful for that perspective. I certainly was, to hash out my thoughts with him on this, but also to make sure that we recognize, you know, there are people who can't agree generally on the way the special counsel approached his overall investigation, but who can disagree on the nuances of what the report did and what the implications of it are.
Yeah, as you write, our lengths of service, our roles in government, and our reasons for leaving offer differ, but we enjoy a significant link. Years ago, at different times and different roles, we worked closely with Mueller as he led the FBI, and you gave Director Mueller his daily briefing. Right. Do I remember that correctly?
Yeah, and General Hayden worked with him on much more important issues of national security decision-making and was in the room where it happened when some important things happened during that time frame. But both of us saw a man who was not seeking to self-aggrandize, certainly, but wasn't even seeking to define his role super widely. In fact, he was trying to do the job in front of him and focus like a laser on that. So it should be no surprise that he took the letter he received from the acting attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, and he fulfilled that exact mission, which was to investigate, then to explain his prosecution or declination decisions, and to do not much more than that, certainly not in terms of opining about what the president might or might not be called when he was not able to bring, under DOJ policy, any kind of indictment against the president.
So you write the special counsel has an excruciatingly narrow channel to navigate. What do you mean?
Yeah. On the one hand, he could have essentially lowballed this. He could have come in and said, well, you know what? All I have to do is explain who I prosecuted, who I didn't, and give one sentence each. I mean, really, if you're just explaining your prosecution and declination decisions, you could do that by saying what you did and one sentence of why you didn't do it. We didn't feel we had enough evidence to do it without giving explanations. That would have been wholly unsatisfying, not just for the general public and Congress, assuming we would get that, but even for the Attorney General, who was, in fact, the reader of this report. On the other hand, Mueller could have certainly overreached. He could have opined about criminal charges that he knew he could not bring by following Department of Justice policy. And in doing so, he could have actually made himself a political actor in a way that he has completely abjured for 2 years. So he had that narrow channel to operate in. In doing so, there are some things he did, and those are honorable things. He got convictions or guilty pleas or indictments from 34 people in 3 companies in less than 2 years. That's good. But what General Hayden and I wanted to talk about is the honor in what Mueller did not do. Not only did he not go out there and counterpunch and retweet and try to counter the president's narrative over the last 2 years, he stayed silent and preserved his integrity, but he decided not to overreach. He decided not to go beyond DOJ policy, which in effect prevented the president from making his claims of witch hunt stick. Because nobody's really talking about this being a witch hunt anymore except the president. Those really didn't catch on. But if Mueller had violated the policies of his own institution, the Department of Justice that he was operating under, those charges of witch hunt might actually start to catch on. Mueller played it right. Mueller played it straight.
Yeah. So you also mentioned that he didn't test the limits of his mandate by holding and hoarding all of the cases that he possibly could have stumbled upon. One of the, I think, most dramatic developments to at least keep in mind is the way that he farmed out many of those cases, right? I mean, right. That he did not hold everything within his purview. That's also something he did not do.
Sure. And General Hayden and I weren't trying to get inside the head of Bob Mueller. We're not trying to say what he was thinking and get at his motives. However, what he did was keep the special counsel investigation from going on, let's say, into the year 2020. If you did that, even if you got more information from these other cases and saw them through to their completion instead of farming them out to SDNY and other jurisdictions, well, if you do that, you're basically giving the existing Congress a few months during the heat of an election year to decide whether this warrants impeachment hearings, possible impeachment, possible removal. Instead, he used the report in explaining his prosecution and declination decisions. He used the report to give hundreds of pages of information to Congress, and by farming those cases out, did it in a fashion that early in 2019, Congress would have time to look at this, hold its own hearings, and then decide if there is a constitutional role to complete.
Yeah, it's going back to the text of the statute governing the special counsel reads, at the conclusion of the special counsel's work, he or she shall provide the attorney general a confidential report explaining the prosecution or declination decisions reached by the special counsel.
And he did it.
And as you point out, that he did that without even the appearance of prosecutorial overreach. So contrast and compare his approach to the famous slash notorious Jim Comey press conference where he stood up there and he announced that he was not bringing criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. But then he also went through all of the details and he was roundly criticized for taking that decision on himself, but also for dumping out all of the evidence and the arguments even while he was not charging him. So what did Mueller do that was different from what James Comey did?
Both of them were in what I would consider an ethical dilemma, which is both of them are in positions where there is not necessarily one perfectly right choice and one perfectly wrong choice. And there's simply a moral temptation to do the wrong thing. I think both of them faced, frankly, crappy decisions where they felt either thing I do is going to be perceived as wrong based on values that I myself share. But either way I go, it could be perceived as right. Jim Comey made a decision. A lot of people have questioned that decision, but I think he was doing it because he thought this is the ethical best opportunity remaining to me. Mueller did so too, and even in the report, he cites words like fairness, which is a core ethical value, and he's making a decision based on the fairness in the use he employs. It's to make sure that the president has a right to defend himself in a court of law, and by characterizing the president's actions in this report and not in a court of law, which he was prohibited from doing by Department of Justice policy, that that would not be fair. Instead, what he did is he presented all the facts. I mean, he brought the goods in this report and made sure in this political environment it was going to get to Congress so that Congress could consider, under its constitutional role, whether the president deserves to be impeached and removed.
So you're reading, did he make the decision not to venture an opinion on obstruction of justice charges after looking at all the evidence and finding it to be conflicting? Or did he start with the assumption that he did not have the authority to hold the president to account for his behavior while he was still in office?
Let me take it to a bigger point,
yeah,
Charlie,
okay,
which is so many people have put onto Mueller, since probably the day after he was appointed, have put onto him this role of savior. I mean, we've talked before about the fact that there are Mueller prayer candles and Mueller-themed rosaries, and people were seeing him as the knight in shining armor who was going to ride in on the white stallion and rescue the republic. Well, I'm pretty sure Bob Mueller didn't see it that way. I'll let him speak for himself someday. But what was his mission? His mission was not to opine about the president, to characterize the president's actions. His mission was to give the attorney general a confidential report explaining prosecutions or declinations. That's it. He did that. But wisely, in the act of so doing, he actually gave a boatload of evidence to Congress, writing that up as the explanation in hundreds of pages of those decisions he made, but de facto giving them the groundwork to get a head start on any kind of hearings they want to have, whether formal impeachment hearings or an ongoing rolling set of hearings run by government reform, intelligence, or oversight committees. I think he did that well. Whether he intended to do that or not, that's up to him, but that is the result of what he did.
So was he intending that this report would go directly from him, at least in terms of the decision? Obviously, the report is given to the attorney general. Was he leaving intentionally the decision on what to do with the obstruction of justice up to Congress? Did he, based on your reading, you know, did he expect that William Barr was going to insert himself into this and make a judgment before transmitting it to the public and to Congress?
That is a question I look forward to a member of Congress asking Mueller directly when he testifies, because we just don't know. But we do know a few things. First of all, we know that Mueller, although not wanting to insert himself as a political actor into this whole maelstrom of possible impeachment, he is well aware of the political game. He's operated in Washington for most of the last 20 years at a very senior level. He knows how politics work, even if he doesn't want to insert himself as a political actor. Therefore, he knew that the hurricane force winds for this to be released to Congress would be there, and the attorney general was going to be unable to just sit on it and not release part of it. Secondly, Mueller himself, in a factual way, put into the report the role of Congress, writing that Congress may have to apply obstruction laws to what the president did, but he put it in the context of according to the Constitution's system of checks and balances. Well, he named Congress in his own report as the place that would be responsible for seeing this through.
Yeah, let me read that.
That's a sign that he's well aware.
Yeah, you cite this in your piece that this is, again, in volume two, which dealt with obstruction, that any steps during his presidency, this presidency, have to come from Capitol Hill. And there's a direct quote: "The conclusion that Congress may apply the obstruction laws to the president's corrupt exercise of the powers of office accords with our constitutional system of checks and balances and the principle that no person is above the law."
Yes, and in the case of the president, a sitting president, the judgment of Department of Justice lawyers in 1973-74, again in the year 2000, is that a sitting president can't be indicted. Therefore, the law is the ultimate law of our country, the Constitution of the United States, which has a formal role of the Congress through the impeachment and possible removal process to consider whether the president is fit for office.
Okay, so what happens next? You've written the book on removing the president. We have historically never removed a president through the impeachment process, and it seems extremely unlikely that that would result, at least in this term, for Donald Trump. So what happens next? What do you think should happen next?
Well, it's interesting. I understand the arguments, and I have some sympathy for the arguments that the political winds simply say that pursuing an impeachment that does not result in a removal by the Senate would be a failure. And certainly that's the way people have interpreted it since the Bill Clinton impeachment, quote, failed. The impeachment succeeded. He was impeached, but the removal did not happen. The odd thing looking back at this is I'm revisiting some of my own assumptions about that, because that certainly is the political takeaway from the Ken Starr experience and the Bill Clinton impeachment. But when you look at what actually happened politically after that, the idea that this was a disaster for the Republicans doesn't hold as much water as I thought it did. If you go forward to the election in the year 2000, yes, some of the House managers were not in Congress long after that. Got it. But at least one of them, Lindsey Graham, ended up as a U.S. senator. We ended up electing a Republican president about a year after people were saying the Republican Party is finished because of this misguided indictment of the president through impeachment and the quest for removal. You ended up having the Republican Party, if I remember right, only losing one or two seats in the House of Representatives in the year 2000, and then in the next election, gaining those back and more so. Mm-hmm. So this myth that an impeachment that fails to actually remove the president is a death knell for the party is based on a history that we remember that isn't quite in accordance with the facts. Now, I will say the chances of this Senate, as it is now comprised, actually removing the president based on impeachment charges does appear low. I will point people to the public conversation in late 1973 and well into 1974 when people were saying the same thing about the Senate with Richard Nixon and his potential impeachment and removal. And it seemed impossible. And then suddenly in August, it seemed inevitable. And that's what led Nixon to resign. So I'll just point out that, yes, there are political realities on the ground. To some degree, political actors make their own political reality. Think about Barack Obama in 2008, just off of being a state senator and he becomes president. Really? Think about Pete Buttigieg now, a 30-something mayor of a small Midwestern city who is rising in the polls like no one else. Really? This is political reality being made by action, not by people saying, we just can't even pursue this because.
You know, I'm really torn on all of this because I agree with that. I mean, I first of all think that there's a constitutional obligation for Congress to pursue this. Otherwise, the president is literally above the law. And secondly, you are right that if they fail to take action, then they really do normalize this behavior.
Right.
And, you know, but going ahead with it, there's upside and downsides. I mean, the upside, of course, is that it does focus attention legitimately on the president's character, on his behavior, and a lot. And as I've discussed on previous podcasts, we shouldn't assume that people have, in fact, really internalized all of that. And, you know, quite obviously, not everybody is hanging upon every word of this reporter following this the way that we are. And therefore, this could be a dramatic moment in American politics. Of course, the flip side, and I think this is where the Democrats are at right now, is that you know, to use a way overused, you know, analogy or metaphor, it is pouring kerosene upon a, you know, bitterly divided political universe. And if we live in a world of alternative realities and tribal politics, we haven't seen anything yet. Impeachment is the, you know, ultimate, you know, us versus them moment in American politics, and it can be vastly disruptive, especially as you're going into an election year. I can certainly understand why Democrats are slow, but it does seem that there is at least a partial middle ground of being a very aggressive in the investigation, holding the hearings, short of actually launching impeachment. Right. That's been my position. What's your take on that?
Is that
sort of halfway? Is that too, you know, wishy-washy?
Two things. One, also in Lawfare, my colleague Susan Hennessy and Quinton Jurasik wrote an article about impeachment and made the point you did, that in fact it is a constitutional responsibility of Congress to at least open some kind of impeachment inquiry, because otherwise you are setting a precedent that the president can essentially get away with anything as long as there aren't criminal charges. And guess what? There won't be criminal charges,
right?
Because the DOJ memo says we don't indict a sitting president because we have impeachment as a remedy. So you box yourself into a corner if you don't consider impeachment. Secondly, we have to realize we ain't seen nothing yet, because we still have criminal and civil efforts on other fronts going against the president, the Trump Organization, campaign finance issues. Plus, you've got the media spectacle that goes around hearings. You focused on the negative side of that, it'll tear the country apart, it'll pour fire on the situation. I know you remember well. I certainly do. The Clinton impeachment hearings. Was it a tense time politically? Yeah. Did the country still go forward? Yeah. Did other legislation get accomplished? Yes. Did people not work together a year after that because things were so inflamed? No, not at all. Things actually work better than Congress does now in some ways. So I reject the idea that this will stop the country, put it into a dead halt, and lead to fire and brimstone. We see no evidence of that. The hearings, however, do move beyond the report because, honestly, I don't know what percentage of Americans have read even excerpts of the redacted Mueller report, but I'd put it possibly in single digits in terms of the percentage of the American public. But when you have Don McGahn publicly saying some of the things that are written in that report, when you have other people on TV and you see them talking about this stuff, that's the kind of thing that changed Watergate. It wasn't what the special counsel or the independent counsel wrote down back then. It was the fact that there were televised hearings and people were seeing John Dean say things that they could not believe, and Alex Butterfield coming out and talking about tapes in the White House. Having some kind of hearings that let the American people, and of course the members of Congress who are in theory objectively thinking about impeachment, but having that kind of information out there in a way that people can digest is incredibly important for a functioning democracy.
Yeah, and I think whatever they do in terms of impeachment, that information, those hearings have to be held. There's also the question of defending democratic norms when they're under attack. And, you know, my concern is that every time a democratic norm, and we need to come up with a stronger phrase for this, I think, every time one of those democratic norms is violated or shattered, if there's not pushback, then it becomes that much harder to restore it. Right. You know, it becomes – it's the ratchet effect, is that you keep ratcheting down your standards. And so if, in fact, you are confronted – with the corrupt behavior of the president and nothing, and there are no consequences, then that corrupt behavior has in some ways been accepted. I want to give just an example here because as you and I are talking, I'm looking at your colleague Benjamin Wittes, who's put out a very, very important – who's doing a very important project as he's reading through the report and he's keeping a diary and then tweeting out saying, okay, this is what's in the report, and then his comments on it. You know, for example, just one aspect of this, in this section, the president's conduct toward Flynn and Manafort, which of course is redacted. And this discusses the possibility that the president was dangling pardons to influence their testimony. And this is what I'm just going to quote what Ben writes here. He says, "I see no plausible Article II defense here. Yes, the president has the power to pardon. Mm-hmm. And some of the communications here involve public contemplation of the use of that power. But the allegation here is not that a facially valid exercise of Article II power was corrupt or ill-motivated. The argument is that a series of communications, public and private, were corrupt efforts to influence a witness and a jury. Those figures are not part of the executive branch. Had the president publicly offered Manafort a pardon in exchange for money, there would be no question he had committed bribery. The allegation here is very similar. It is the suggestion that he publicly hinted that he would grant a pardon in exchange for something he wanted, to wit, Manafort's silence." And here's the key comment from Benjamin Wittes. "And notably, Trump got what he wanted in this case. Manafort did not end up cooperating to Mueller's satisfaction. Indeed, Mueller concluded that he breached his plea deal by failing to cooperate and by lying to investigators. So the reality here may well be that the president's obstructive conduct actually did, in fact, successfully," I put that word in, "obstruct the investigation. The president hinted that Manafort should not flip and that he would take care of him, and Manafort acted in a fashion consistent with his relying on those assurances. None of this is authorized in any sense by Article 2 of the Constitution."
Right. And let's not forget from your guest last week, Rick Wilson, "Everything Trump touches dies." Who's the one sitting in prison right now? It's Paul Manafort. Even despite all that, it's Manafort. But you point to an interesting issue here. Mm-hmm. It really gets to this overall issue that the kinds of things we're seeing, the kinds of obstruction, are exactly the kinds of things described in Article 1 of impeachment against Richard Nixon.
Exactly.
And then the one thing we forget, and this is something in terms of we ain't seen nothing yet, what have we seen in the last few days? The president and allies saying over and over again, "Mueller's already investigated this. We're not going to cooperate with Congress. We're not going to produce material. We're not going to produce witnesses. No one's going to show up." Well, the special counsel investigation was an executive branch investigation. That is, it was an attorney, a special counsel, but an attorney named by the acting attorney general to pursue this and report to the attorney general. This is now a constitutional process. This is now a legislative process if Congress is putting out subpoenas for materials. And let me read briefly from Article 3, the impeachment article against Richard Nixon, which was passed with Republican support in the Judiciary Committee. It says that the president was actually doing things like not responding to subpoenaed papers and things that were deemed necessary by the committee in order to resolve by direct evidence fundamental factual questions relating to presidential direction, knowledge, or approval of actions. Well, that sounds a whole lot like what's going on right now. They go on to say, in refusing to produce these papers and things, Richard M. Nixon, substituting his judgment as to what materials were necessary for this inquiry, interposed the powers of the presidency against the lawful subpoenas of the House of Representatives, thereby assuming to himself functions and judgments necessary to the exercise of the sole power of impeachment vested by the Constitution in the House of Representatives. If you substitute Richard M. Nixon out for a different name right now, that actually appears to be the White House strategy, is to rewrite Article 3 of impeachment against Richard Nixon with today's data. That is one that actually could end up turning around and hurting the president as much as any of these other things so far.
And the fact that they're doing it in broad daylight in real time doesn't change the fact that it is a gross abuse of power.
Right.
It does not change all of that. So this, I think, strengthens the argument that that you have been making, that Congress just has to do something about it.
You have to at least pursue it.
You have to at least
hold hearings. Now, whether those are formal impeachment hearings in the Judiciary Committee or whether it is simply the Judiciary Committee holding hearings and not calling them impeachment and allowing Representative Cummings to hold some hearings in his committee and allowing Representative Schiff to hold some hearings in his committee, getting this information collected and then used potentially in articles of impeachment, that's almost beside the point is how they get there. But the fact is, issuing subpoenas on issues that they are constitutionally entitled to get information about in order to serve their role, that is something that, to the extent the president continues to disrupt that, he's just digging himself in further.
Yeah, you also made a point that I don't want to gloss over, which is that, you know, the narrative is, well, okay, so the Mueller investigation is over, we're past, there are polls showing that people want to move on, but we need to remind ourselves again and again, no, this whole investigation is not over. We don't know the counterintelligence piece of this investigation, which you presume, you know, is continuing. And of course, there were references to 14 ongoing investigations, including investigations in the Southern District of New York and in the state of New York, where the attorney general is getting apparently Deutsche Bank to give them financial records. And at this point, we don't know where that's going. I think from the beginning, the White House has had a sense that some of those investigations pose more danger than the Mueller investigation. So this story is not only not over, we may still not even be at the halfway point as far as we know.
It is far from over. Yes, the Mueller investigation is over, but I'll hearken back to my earlier point. People who saw Bob Mueller as the final voice on this, ironically, now that appears to be the president's interpretation, is Bob Mueller was the final voice on this. That was never correct. His mission was to look at criminal acts related to the specific issues put to him by the letter from Rod Rosenstein. But that did not have to do with all these other issues. Frankly, Charlie, the counterintelligence investigation, which appears to be running normally within the FBI now, very rarely does a counterintelligence investigation lead to public information. The vast majority of them never do. They are kept track of, but prosecutions don't come often. So I don't think that's where the meat of this will be. I think a lot of it will be in the hearings where information comes out. And again, the president acting starting on the day that this redacted report came out, everything he is doing and saying could end up being the fodder for an article of impeachment itself based on how he reacts to Congress's legitimate role moving forward.
No, you make a good point on the counterintelligence. I suppose what I was really thinking in the back of my mind, I should have put it more clearly, is that the ongoing Russian attack on our elections is, well, it's ongoing. And who knows what's going to happen in 2020 with that. The reports from last week in the New York Times suggesting that Kirstjen Nielsen was warned not to even bring it up because it might it might somehow violate the president's safe space on all of this. So if there is significant damage from an attack, the record is pretty clear that this is a president who has downplayed that threat, who has ignored that threat, and certainly is providing no leadership against that threat. So who knows where that's going to go? As I can't remember whether I said it on the podcast or someplace else. You know, given the ROI, the return on investment from Vladimir Putin's attack on our elections in 2016, which has to be the best ROI ever in the history of these sorts of things, why would he not redouble his efforts in 2020?
He certainly hasn't seen a reason not to.
No.
I'll actually build on something that Acting Chief of Staff Mulvaney said in response to this. Of course, he said, well, the problem isn't this administration. You know, Trump has done this, this, and this against Russia. Look back at what Obama didn't do starting in 2014. Well, first of all, back in 2014, what we're talking about wasn't yet happening. But it's a continual reaction to look backward, to look backward, to look backward. The whole issue about this reporting on Secretary Nielsen, if true, is she was looking forward. She wasn't even trying to say, let's relitigate the 2016 election. She was solely saying, look at what is happening already related to the 2020 election. Let's focus on that. And it was, we can't even bring that up because the president feels insecure about the 2016 election. That is dangerous, and it certainly does not give Putin and others in Russia a reason to stop.
You know, this is something that I talked with Julian Zelizer about on Friday. We're in this new stage where the president is also, just as you mentioned before, just flat out stonewalling all of the subpoenas from Congress, and not just some. And it's one of those moments where, again, we're reminded how much of what we had assumed was part of our system of checks and balances really was informal, was on an honor system. Because I think what Congress is finding out is that they have very limited powers in forcing the president to disgorge information. So they issue a subpoena. The president says, hey, screw you.
And let's not pretend that's new, Charlie. I mean, that's happened in previous administrations where presidents – it goes back to Washington. Washington refused to provide some documents to the Congress that they requested on Alexander Hamilton's advice. Obama did not let Eric Holder go and testify, and he was held in contempt.
And nothing happened.
But that was not related to an actual investigation of the president that might be related to the constitutional role of impeachment. That's what elevates this even more.
I see. No, and I think the key point being, though, that that we're also finding out the limited ability short of impeachment for Congress to be able to work its will, which again is something, you know, we as you point out, it has happened before. Whether it's happened on the scale, we don't know.
Right.
So what do you think is going to happen next? What would you, if Nancy Pelosi called you up this afternoon and said, okay, what should I do?
Give me two different questions. What should she do, and what will happen?
Exactly.
What will happen? There are so many variables out there, including all these other investigations, including how far the White House goes to perhaps literally prevent any material or any witness from going to Congress having to do with any of these questions. There are so many unknowns, it's hard to predict at this point. What they should do is pretty clear, which is the constitutional role, as handed to them by the situation and as reminded to them by Bob Mueller, is you need to hold hearings. You need to collect information. Yes, the special counsel collected a lot of information, but that is a distinct role than the legislative role in pursuing information that is, at a minimum, oversight and possibly related to impeachment. You got to do that one way or another, whether you call it a formal impeachment hearing or not. The political side of it, a lot of people, I think, are overthinking it. And again, assuming that the possible benefits of inaction on impeachment, that is, the actions of just letting this ride because the president is weak, and in 2020, we don't want to risk the fact that he's a weak candidate. Well, there were a whole lot of Republicans in the primaries in 2016 who thought the same thing. There was one woman named Hillary Clinton who in 2016 thought the same thing. Basing your inaction on impeachment based on what you think is likely to happen without it is not a sure bet at all. And again, you can create your own political reality by bringing things up in the hearings that do start to change things just the way that they did in the Nixon case.
David Preece, thank you so much. David is the Chief Operating Officer of the Lawfare Institute. You ought to also read his new book, When did the book come out, actually? It's not a new book. It
came out right around Election Day.
Right around Election Day.
So it's a few months old now.
How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives, or perhaps all of the above. And the piece, What Mueller Got Right, is up on the Lawfare blog, co-written with General Michael Hayden. Again, thank you for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.